Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
Recording live at Days of the Dead in Los Angeles, overlooking the glamorous Los Angeles International Airport, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. So it's a special live event with an audience, as you hear, and our guests are David Howard Thornton, Art the Clown himself, and Damien Leone, director, writer-director of the Terrifier movies. So we're here to have a good time. We're here to find out. We're talk about things that we love. We're at a horror convention. And what could be a better place for us to talk about our passion for this genre? So, Damien, how did it start for you? Your mother was a horror fan, right?
Correct. That's really, it goes back to my mother naming me after The Omen.
Wow.
Yeah. Naming me after The Omen. She was loved movies, loved horror, was obsessed with that name when she saw the movie for some reason, and it had to be spelled the way it was spelled in the movie.
So she with the E-N.
Had to be an E, yeah. And then she just introduced me to, you know, I knew where my name came from at a very young age, and she would let me watch horror movies, and just, not necessarily horror movies, but they could be R-rated movies, action movies, like we watched Beastmaster, Red Sonja, Rambo. She took me to see RoboCop in the movie theaters when I was four. I mean, that's the one of my favorite. That had a huge impact.
This
on
was
me.
A very liberal household.
Yes, very. Yeah.
Can you take off your hat so we can see if there are three sixes on there? Okay. Oh, okay. That must They're have not, been makeup. Yeah. Anyway,
I thought about getting that tattoo. I did, but I decided.
If you're gonna get tattooed, that seems to be the one.
That's
yeah.
The one.
So that was where your love for the genre started. Do you remember the first horror movie that you saw that really had an impact on you?
Yeah, Jaws, and it's still my favorite movie of all time.
Wow.
Yeah, so Jaws, and then she took me to see The Lost Boys in the movie theaters when I was four, and that is still, that had a huge impact on me.
Four for you was 12 for most
right.
of us.
Right, I was, yeah. You know? Yeah. I would bring the my friends who were not allowed to watch those movies. They'd come over my house, and we'd sneak in my room, and I'd put the VHS tapes in. Their parents had no idea what I was showing them. Toxic Avenger. We were like seven.
Horror should be illicit, yeah. Don't you think?
Yeah. But it was really because I was a huge fan, and I gravitated toward the slashers. And I would rent all the VHS tapes. And at the beginning of Friday the 13th, Part 6 VHS tape, it had the coming attractions to Scream Greats, which is a documentary on Tom Savini. And it's the first time I saw what a makeup artist
the
did.
Fangoria
the Fangoria doc. The Fangoria one. And that a man created all these monsters that I already knew and I loved. And I was like, oh, my God, this is artwork. I understood what it was. And I just really gravitated toward that. And when I got a little older, she took me to meet Tom Savini at a horror convention, Chiller Convention
in New Jersey.
So starstruck. I got to meet him. He was so cool. And coincidentally, a vendor was selling starter Ben Nye makeup kits.
Wow.
And I bought that and a bottle of
Ben Nye was a studio makeup guy at Universal, I think.
Yeah, correct.
For years back in the 40s
Legendary
and 50s.
Legendary makeup, yeah. and a bottle of mint flavored blood, and I went home, and I just, when I opened that kit, that was the first day of the rest of my life, and I just started putting all that makeup on myself, creating cuts, putting them on my friends, and sending them home to their parents. Their parents had no idea I was messing with makeup effects, so I was really freaking them out, and getting that rush from fooling a parent was just the greatest thing ever. So that all led into filmmaking, but it was really special effects first.
Yeah, amazing. Well, David, how did it start for you? You were in Huntsville, Alabama. You were in New York, Damien.
Correct.
So that made it a little more media accessible.
Yeah.
Huntsville, Alabama. How does that lead to your being here in Los Angeles promoting your movies?
That's a little bit different from his. Because I also came from a household where we didn't really watch horror movies. My dad would watch them late at night on, like, you know, Sci-Fi or something like that. But, like, my mom was a big chicken. So she thought The Fall of the House of Usher was the scariest movie ever made. And
fair enough.
Yeah.
Roger Corman.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
Vincent Price.
I do remember, though, like when I was a kid, we had just gotten a VCR in early 80s, and it was when Poltergeist came out on VHS, and so they had a watch party of Poltergeist over at our house. Of course, I was like a little kid at the time, and I was put to bed.
That's how I met Toby Hooper. I was doing publicity on Poltergeist.
Oh, my God. But they had the watch party, and I snuck out of bed, and I was watching the movie over, like, I pulled up a chair, was watching it over, like, the counter or something like that, and the whole, the clown strangulation scene came up, and that freaked me out, and that, of course, you know, exposed me to everybody there that I was there, and I was like, oh, no, no. So that was my first time ever seeing a horror movie. That kind of traumatized me. My mom used that movie to get me to behave, too, because she's like, I used to sit right in front of the TV as a kid and block everything. And my mom's like, if you sit in front of the TV like that, if you sit too close, you're going to get pulled into the
TV. Carol Ann is going to drag you in.
Yeah. And for years, I would, like, if the TV was on, I would walk a wide berth around the TV.
But it's interesting that the clown was such an integral part
it's
of kinda, the background.
It's between that, and I also had an old Mego figure of the Joker from back in the day, and that figure used to freak me out for a while. So it's funny that but now clowns don't scare me. I think I got that fear out as a
now
kid.
Now that you're the scariest clown out there.
It's art therapy, really.
Ah, excellent. So, Damien, why do you think clowns can be so scary?
It's a great question, and now, of course, because I'm surrounded by clown culture, which I never expected to happen in my life.
Clowns tried.
Yeah, I'm always trying to analyze that, and I think something that's so simple and gets overlooked big time is the impact of a white face.
Yeah.
Because I think if you have a clown that doesn't have the white face makeup, they're nowhere near as scary. Nowhere near. And I think it's the reason why Linda Blair's face is so horrifying in The Exorcist, is there's something, a white face, it's immediately subconsciously synonymous with death. So I think that's a big part
of it. It's bloodless, yeah.
Bloodless, right. No red pigment. Right? Immediately your mind goes to, okay, that is a dead person that should not be looking at me and smiling. Yeah, so that right there is just very creepy. And there's just something so abnormal and alien about the way they move and always being happy. It's so freaky and disturbing. And if you put a knife in that person's hand and they're coming at you, I mean, that's a recipe for, that's nightmare fuel right there.
And good for both of you.
Yeah.
Very much so.
So, but you started doing makeup effects. Tell me about how that began. Were you doing just things like you were talking about, scaring neighbors and parents and that sort of thing? How did that translate into a career of actually doing these professionally?
Yeah. Well, I could tell you the first thing that I ever learned how to do was messing with liquid latex, and it was very simple. I would put a very thin layer on my face where it was just basically you're putting a layer of glue, and without powdering it, I would fold the skin on top of itself and make this great gash, a great seam. And it was literally seamless, flawless. You could look at it, be this close, and it just looks like a cut. And then
that's like a Lon Chaney Sr. thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Very old school, very simple. And I put a trickle of blood. And I did that on every one of my friends' faces. And like I said, and we sent them home to their parents saying we were playing football, and they cut their face on the license plate. And we freaked out every parent. I mean, one parent, my friend Rob, his father had just gotten home from work, and we did that, and he's like, literally started cursing at him. He's like, Jesus Christ. He's like, I just got home. Now I got to take you to the goddamn emergency room. And we were just dying. It was so amazing. We got such a rush. But then my buddy's father had a camcorder and lent it to us. And then I was trying to replicate all these Tom Savini gags with the camera. And then that turned into making short horror films like every other filmmaker with all my buddies. And then when I got out of high school, I didn't have money to go to film school, but my mother gave me enough money to take a film class at New School University. And it was just an introductory aesthetics of directing class where it's just film theory and whatnot, and we're watching all foreign movies. And there was this one assignment where we had to make a 2-minute short film with no dialogue, just action. And that didn't mean action like an action movie. It just had to
be... Right, not crashing cars.
Correct. But being me, I'm like, all right, I'm going to make this as bloody and as crazy as possible. So we had... I had two of my friends having a knife fight. I had just got a... there was a snowstorm, and we went in the cemetery behind my house, and I filmed them having this really bloody knife fight with, like, Raging Bull-type blood spray every time, like, Kurosawa blood. And it freaked out. Like, the class was like, whoa, that they were making all these artsy... 2-minute videos, and then all of a sudden it's these two guys slicing each other up and blood flying everywhere. And it left an impression on the teacher in that class who was also an aspiring filmmaker himself. And then, you know, I didn't go to that school anymore. And then about a year later, he emailed me and he said, hey, I remembered your short film. I remembered the blood. It was really cool. He's like, I'm making a movie. I need some special effects. He's like, do you still do that? Would you be interested? I was like, hell yeah. I was like out of high school doing nothing. You know, I didn't have
And this was a professional movie being made.
Yeah, yeah. Professional, low budget, yeah, film. Yeah, it's called Love. But yeah, it was it was cool. So that was my first time working on a on an actual movie. And then it was just all word of mouth there. People would recommend me, refer me to other filmmakers, and I was freelancing doing makeup effects for a while.
So David, were you a horror fan as a kid?
I was late to the game because of my mom's fear. But I finally got into it my senior year of high school when Scream 2 came out. Because everybody was wanting to go see it. I was doing a show at the time, a play. I was doing, like, I think it was A Christmas Carol. And my cast wanted to go out and see Scream 2. And there was a girl in the cast I had a crush on. And I'm like, she's like, are you going to come? I'm like, God, I can't chicken out in front of this girl. So I'm like, okay, fine. I'll go. And I had a blast. I was like, oh my God, why is my mom so afraid of all this kind of stuff? And I was like, well, you know, I can't really watch these at home because mom doesn't like them. But next year in college,
yeah, that's when you're 18, change. You don't want to tell people because my mom doesn't like.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I'll wait. And so, like, and my buddy that I was my roommate in college, he was one of my best friends in high school. He came from a very strict Southern Baptist, you know, family too. So he never watched any of this stuff. And we're like, we're in college now. We can do whatever we want. So we would go every weekend and just rent a whole stack of tapes, and we'll just do each weekend like a different series. So we'd do like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies, and we'd do like, you know, Friday the 13th, all that kind of Shining, all that. Just do all this. We had fun, and we just caught up on everything we had been missing out on.
So you met a friend who you could share that with. Yeah. So many horror fans, and I would imagine most of the people here, were outcasts and did not have a whole lot of friends who could share in that love of genre. Damien, it sounds like you had plenty of people who were into it that you could peel their faces off and things like that.
They didn't have a choice. I just tortured all my friends. But they weren't into horror. You know, I was lucky that I grew up with a nice amount of kids my age in my neighborhood. But they were into sports and all those traditional things that you're into. But so I was the monster kid. I was the outcast of my group. But they loved, especially when we got into making the short films, they loved that. I mean, when you're a kid, when you're 12 years old, 13, there's not many things you could do to pass the time. So they loved just like making movies, going into the woods, getting covered in blood. They thought it was a cool way to pass some time. But yeah, they really didn't have a choice. I mean, I need a monster. I need to turn you into a zombie.
Well, what is it about fear, horror movies in particular, that sparks you? I mean, I've had the passion from a very, very young age as well. I like all kinds of movies, but I'm drawn especially to the genre and especially in making genre films.
Yeah. I love visuals, and I gravitate toward creatures in particular, monsters, just things that are not of this earth. Like, I'm not so much interested in, although I appreciate something like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Ah, right? Great film.
Great movie. But that's very close to home. Like, I'd much rather the fantastic, right? Mm-hmm. I'd rather, you know, the shark in Jaws, even though that's a, you know. But, you know, Godzilla,
but
King Kong,
creatures,
the monsters. I just really took a liking to them. I love just otherworldly things. They fascinated me. But there's also something deeper, something cathartic that everybody, you know, understands, where it's you're conquering the fears that we deal with every day, and that, you know, when you leave the house, you know, we don't think about it, but this could be your last time leaving the house. I mean, and we're plagued with that every day. Every time.
Thanks for putting that in my head right now.
You know, and but these horror movies definitely help with that. There is so much violence and horror in real life, and I think we just need a way to kind of cope with that, and that's a way to do it.
As a performer, what do you? Everybody seems to want to be the villain. Art the Clown is the most colorful character in a movie. The villain is always the most colorful character. How do you approach that?
I love playing,
because nobody feels they're bad people in real life.
No, it's that's actually a trait of a lot of villains I like, or the villains that don't realize they're the villain. It's like they think they're what they're doing is, you know, altruistic. They're doing it for the betterment of, you know, themselves or society or something like that. But then you also have those villains that know they are the villain, and
like
they
Art
revel.
The Clown.
Yeah, and that's Art. That's Art. He knows he's a villain. He's like, you know, like how the Joker is. He knows he's a villain. He knows what a joke the world really is, and he just like, you know what? I'm gonna embrace this side of me, and I'm gonna have fun. And that's what Art is like as well. And it's very freeing in a lot of ways to be able to play a character like that. I have fun with it. It's because I'm able to do things I would never do as myself, and I know I'm able to do them in ways that were, you know. It's fantasy, so I know I'm actually not gonna be hurting anybody or anything like that. And it's weird. It's a kind of therapeutic in some ways, because like if you're having a bad day or something like that, then like, well, let's do a little kill scene where you do something like that, and you just like get that frustration out like that. Oh yeah, they'll do that sometimes to me. It's like, just pretend this is such and such and so and so, and I'm like, yeah. Like,
well, you
that felt good.
You also have makeup on.
Yeah.
And that, when you look at yourself in the makeup trailer, in the mirror, as you're about to go into it, I mean, you don't see David.
Oh, no.
You see Art.
No.
And it's got to be so freeing and emancipating.
It really is. And it's because I've always hated playing characters that are like myself. That's one of the things I really, just not just horror, but just acting in general, is it's escapism for the artist. It's like you can be someone else. And it goes back to my younger years when I was bullied a lot, or like the years after my mom passed away from cancer. That's how I escaped the pain I was dealing with. I was like, I'm able to, for a few hours in rehearsal or on stage, escape the trauma that I'm going through in my own life, and to be someone else, but also bring joy and merriment and fun to other people. And it's very freeing in that way.
Well, there's a lot to be said for the therapeutic value of the horror movie. And it is particularly appealing to a younger audience because they still feel immortal. They've not been approached by death. They've not been touched by death and mortality. And the whole idea of whistling past the graveyard is a very valid one. But it's also a way to confront your fears in the safest possible manner. You go into a movie theater and you play tag with your fears, and you're not it, you know?
It's the thrill of the hunt. I mean, it's very primal. It's still in us. So you, and I think we still want that. We yearn for that. But seeing, you know, you don't want to suffer the consequences, right? You don't want
exactly.
to get eaten by the animal in the jungle. But watching a horror movie, you get to feel that thrill, but then you can walk out and go back
yeah,
home, and
just
you're
like
safe
the
in your
coaster.
Bed.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
the roller coaster. You get on this terrifying ride, but you know you're going to be okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what about that transition from makeup effects guy? What was the point where you finally said, it's time for me to make my own movie?
Yeah, so after, after high school, it's like I couldn't go to film school, and it's like, you know, I knew I wanted to do this with my life. I knew I wanted to make movies. There was nothing else I could do. So I said, I need to, since I can't go to film school, I need to make a film that's going to be my calling card, basically, and hopefully I could showcase what I could do as a director and as a makeup effects artist. I'll make this. I'll put it into some festivals, and hopefully somebody likes it, and Hollywood comes knocking on my door. Like, that was the mindset, of course.
Right.
Didn't quite happen like that, but what did happen was, it was the first time I created Art the Clown in this short film. And this was why I call it my throwing shit at the wall short film. It was called The Ninth Circle. Basically, almost like everything else I do, it did not have much of a plot, and it was just visual, horror visuals, basically. But it was me sort of throwing all these archetypes and tropes that I loved into it, and a lot of makeup effects, and just hoping something just stuck. And Art was in the first 3 minutes. He sets up the short film, and he's basically harassing, terrorizing this woman who's waiting for a train.
So you did everything. You wrote it, you directed it, and you did the makeup
effects. Yes, yeah. And people, once they saw it, you know, they said, "Wow, you know, that was cool. The effects were cool, the creatures, the monsters," and everybody said that clown, though, that clown at the beginning is so friggin' creepy. He's so cool.
Were you
cool.
in the short, David?
No, it was actually, yeah, it was my buddy Mike, who was, again, one of these friends that didn't have a choice. I said, "I need a clown. I have a mold of your face." I'm like, "You're playing this." He's like, I don't act." I'm like, "You just got to sit there and smile." I'm like, "Charles, but you could do it." So he got roped into playing the original Art the Clown, and he did a really good job. But everybody just who I showed that said, "You have to keep making more things with that clown. There's something there." And I did. And I just kept making more short films. And I just he was my North Star that I just kept following. I knew there was something there.
But the world of independent film is really tough to crack, especially today. There are so many filmmakers, you would know their name, you'd know them well, who can't make their living off of the movies that they make because of the various platforms, and you know, the independent distributors will pick up a $3 million movie for $50,000. Yep. Tell me how you made that step to making the feature film.
Yes, yeah, so it was the first short film, then I made another short film with Art the Clown, where I really fleshed him out and really turned him into a slasher, and I really started to understand who he was. And that was called Terrifier, and that now was going to be the official Art the Clown calling card and trying to get somebody to give me money to turn that into a feature. Did not happen that way for a long time. Again, and this because just to try and encourage, a lot of people come up to me and they think Terrifier is an overnight success. I created Art the Clown in 2005 in that first short film. I was still delivering flowers writing Terrifier 2. That was my 9-to-5 job when I wasn't freelancing or doing something.
Flowers, monsters. Yeah. I don't know.
I make no
right
sense.
Right brain, left brain.
It's like Frankenstein's monster. With
That's right.
So I'll try and make this quick because it was a long journey. So nothing really happened with those short films. They were in a couple of festivals. And then I was like, all right, YouTube was sort of a new thing back then. This is like 2010. It wasn't what it is now. So I just threw them on there. And Terrifier in particular started getting a lot of views considering it was back then. It was a 20-minute short film. Had like over 100,000 views. And this indie producer contacted me having seen it, and he said, "I'm making a horror anthology based on Halloween shorts that I'm finding on YouTube that are already made." He said, "I love your clown. I want him to be the poster of this movie." So I was like, "Yeah, I have this other short with him too." And then he wanted to use other filmmakers. I wound up talking him into just letting me be the only filmmaker and giving me some extra funds to go pad out the movie, which we did. And that was called All Hallows Eve. It was never something I wanted to make, but it was the first time I got a movie picked up and distributed. It was in Redbox and Walmarts and things like that. So I thought that was the coolest thing ever at that point. So then I always wanted to just keep making Terrifier the feature. That was always the goal. And even him, you know, he said, I'll never forget this. I tried to get him to give me the money, and he said, "I've been reaching around, you know, reaching out, asking people." He said, "The unanimous note I keep getting is clowns can't sell a movie." Right? And I was like, "Oh man, you know."
Since just, when?
Yeah. It was very, very disheartening. So then nobody wanted to give me money for it, and you know, platforms now were like fundraising, like Kickstarter and Indiegogo were starting to come about. So I said, "I'll try it that way." So I was going to try and raise money for Terrifier, and I sent out the Kickstarter campaign to everybody I knew in my emails, my contacts. And a buddy of mine, Phil Falcone, who's now my producing partner, I'd done special effects for a movie he worked on. We had a really good time, had a good relationship. I sent it to him, and he calls me on the side, just calls me up, and he goes, "What are you trying to do here?" I'm like, he's like, "You're asking for like $15,000. You're trying to make a feature film." He's like, "How much do you think you could really make this movie for? What do you need?" I was like, "Honestly, I made the short for like $5,000. I maxed out a credit card. I said, you know, make that into an 80-minute movie, probably $30,000-$35,000. I could probably make this movie. He goes, I'll give you the money tomorrow. He goes, I just want to hang out with you while you're doing all the special effects. He's like, hopefully I could learn something. And he gave me the money the next day.
$30,000 film school.
$35,000 yeah. film yeah. school. Yeah, right, exactly. And so that was huge. That was everything. I mean, that was the true beginning, because if I hadn't met that guy, who knows? If I hadn't met Phil, might not be here right now. Probably wouldn't. And then so that was. But again, it wasn't an easy road. Even then making that movie, but then trying to get distribution for that was tough. Nobody wanted the movie. People wanted to cut it. They didn't want to pay for it. And it's just sticking to your guns eventually. Where finally I found a distributor who was willing to pay us something I thought was reasonable and keeping it intact. So they picked it up. The company was Epic. And what wound up happening that really helped us...
The parent of Dread Central.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. So what wound up happening was they sold it to... After like 2 years, they wound up getting it to Netflix. And then once it went on Netflix, then it got in front of a lot of eyes and a lot of people started... becoming fans of it and seeing it that way. Right? We hear it all the time that people, they never heard of it, and they're scrolling through Netflix, and then they just saw Art's face, and they're like, I have to see what's going on there.
Just the availability on the streaming platforms. Yeah, there you go. Now, David, what were the roles you imagined yourself playing when you first became an actor?
Not this one. No, exactly. No, I never even imagined I would be doing horror films at all. I always, because I'm like, I've always been honest with my physique. I was like, if I'm ever going to do a horror film, I'm going to be one of the victims, like Randy or something like that. So I'm like, no one's going to ever cast me as the villain. I'm like, no, as much as I love playing villains, I'm like, nah.
But
that's
what
just
were
the...
you, what was your ambition? What were the
well,
characters?
The irony yeah. of this is he's the man of 1,000 voices. Mm-hmm. He's Mr. Cartoon Voice. Yeah. And I right. took away 50% of his, you know, his
well, yeah,
tool
you do a
kit.
Lot of games. Yeah. You do a lot of voiceover work.
That's
yeah.
what I really want to do. I wanted to do a lot of animation.
Yeah, that's how I got my SAG yeah. card, was doing voices for the Pink Panther. New news.
Yeah, that's why that was one of the big things I wanted to do, because I was as a kid. That's when I learned when Who Framed Roger Rabbit came out. That's when I learned about Mel Blanc doing all the voices for all the Looney Tunes characters, and I learned about Dawes Butler and Don Messick, and I was like, oh my god, these guys do all of these voices. That's awesome. And I just discovered I had a knack for mimicry, and so as a child I was just doing voices for like just all my action figures from Ninja Turtles and all that kind of stuff. And it just, anytime I heard an interesting voice, I'm like, I gotta learn how to do that. And I was just cultivating a skill set over the years, and I was like, that's what I should do. I should try to get into voiceover work. And I also was a musical theater guy, so I wanted to, that's why I moved to New York instead of LA. I wanted to go up to New York and be on Broadway. And I never got to actual Broadway, but I did tour with How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the musical, for five
wow.
years. So that's wow. So that was a lot of fun to do. I was the understudy for the wonderfully talented Stephen Carl, who was Robbie Rotten from the show Lazy Town. And
nice.
He was a great mentor for me, because all my life, I'd done a lot of physical comedy. That was my thing. I also had a great education in great physical comedians as a child. My parents had me watching the Chaplin movies, Marx Brothers, all that kind of stuff.
Clowning and mime,
you know?
And all of those
yeah, yeah.
things.
And I did a lot of community theater, a lot of children's theater, because children love physical comedy. They're more into the physical than the verbal comedy. And so all those years, I was just kind of just honing my skills. People always ask me, because there's a rumor out there that I went to mime school. I'm like, no. I just learned from my betters and adapted, especially like my aunt gifted me a box set of Mr. Bean videos when I was a teenager.
Great.
And I was just infatuated with that kind of character. I love that idea of a silent, mischievous character that just... He's like an adult child, but a total brat. And I'm like, I love that idea. And I always wanted a chance to play a character like that. And so when I saw All Hallows Eve, before I even knew about Terrifier, this is like a year or so before the auditions for Terrifier, and I saw All Hallows Eve, and I saw Art in that, I'm like, oh my gosh, he's kind of like an evil Mr. Bean. I was like, what a fun character. I would love to play a character like that one day. That would be such an interesting... I was like, okay, maybe something like that could work for horror. I'm like, I don't know. Who knows if... You know, I don't know, but that would be fun. And then the audition for Terrifier came up, and I'm like, oh, my God, because they were looking for a tall, skinny guy with, you know, experience in physical comedy or clowning. And I'm like, this is perfect. I want to do this, and this would be a fun way to change up the game in some ways. And
so, Damien, this very gentle guy here, when he comes in to audition for you, tell me the transformation from David to Art.
I knew I wanted him right away, as soon as I saw him walk into the room. Because my buddy Mike, who played him, again, it wasn't necessarily like starting from scratch or traditional casting method. This was my friend that I knew, and I already had his face mold, and he was accessible. And I said, you know, I need this clown, and because I knew I wanted to sculpt a prosthetic for him. And like I said, he kind of just got roped into playing him. But now that he, again, and he's not an actor, so I did give him the opportunity to play Art the Clown in Terrifier, but he just didn't want to act, you know, it's just not his cup of tea. So now that I had to start from scratch, I said, I want somebody who's taller and thinner, like much thinner, because they're going to look way creepier. And then David was about the sixth person to come into the audition. As soon as he walked into the room and I saw him, I said... And he had this big smile. I said, ooh, he's going to look really good in that prosthetic. And then he's like, they didn't have sides or anything. I think just the casting call online was of you're here for a killer clown or whatever, for a horror feature. He's like, well, I didn't have any sides. What am I supposed to do? He's like, and I'm like, well, don't worry. You don't speak. I said, I just really need to see you act as if you're decapitating somebody, but do it in a very like gleeful manner. You're having a great time. And that was it. And he's like,
so the miming and clowning was good. Homework.
Yes. Yeah. And then that's it. I mean, on action, he just morphed into what you see now as Art the Clown with all this theatricality and the sort of Jim Carrey Grinch and all these, like, the kind of like more like the mask kind of stuff he's doing. But I just saw now, oh my God, like, this is a real actor now. This is a theatrical actor who can bring so much more to the character that I ever envisioned originally. Originally, Art's played very straight. He's more just like a man dressed as a clown, whereas now David turned him into a clown.
A character.
Yeah. And I said, you know, we could have a lot of fun with this. Like, and that's what we do. I mean, like, Dave could bring him to an 11, and I have to maybe reel him back to a 5 or something. I don't want him to do any clown.
That's your job.
Like, right, exactly. But now I have this whole spectrum of wonderful performance to choose from that I didn't have there originally. So I just knew it was going to be amazing. And I basically shut the audition down after that. It was me and Phil in the room watching. We were getting a kick out of what he was doing. And when he left, I turned to Phil. I said, what else are we really looking for here? I was like, that's like everything I want. I was like, let's have him come back and put the prosthetic on him and have him do that all over again. And that's what we did.
With a pizza delivery guy. Yeah, that was fun.
well, tell me about your first day on the set, where the movie is actually in production. You're coming out of makeup and you're walking onto the set. What was the first scene you shot?
That was, I think...
Do you remember the first scene? I think it was you actually walking up the street. Was it?
No, it was me walking down the stairs pursuing Tara in the garage with the cars. Yeah, and this was my first time really doing film work too. I had done extra work, but never anything of this nature, and so I was very nervous because
been in a production this big before.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, this was a non-union show, non-DGA, non-WGA, non-SAG, all of that. So, all bets are off. Anything goes.
Sam Raimi, Evil Dead 1. I mean, this was as guerrilla filmmaking as you could possibly get.
Yeah, in this very, very dilapidated building in Trenton, New Jersey that is like, oh, my God, this place was disgusting.
But I mean, it's the Garden State.
Oh, yeah. It could definitely turn into a garden one day. But, yeah, it was very unnerving for me because everybody else on that set had worked on sets before, so I was the newbie, and I was like, oh my gosh, and I have, of course, being like basically the face of the franchise, you know, I didn't know it was going to be a franchise at the time, but still, I was like, a lot of this rests on me, and I'm like,
But you're also hitting marks and doing things you don't do the same way in the theater.
Exactly, I'm so used to theater, you know, it's like where you rehearse for weeks, and then you do the production. This is like, just go and hope everything works out. But I was lucky because Jenna Cannell, who plays Tara, you know, she has worked on several productions before that, and she was a stunt actress too. And so, because I had never really done a lot of fight scenes, and that was the first night where it was me attacking Tara there in the garage, and now I was having to get on top of her and do horrible things to her, and I'm like, I was so nervous about hurting, you know, Jenna. And there's actually a moment that you see in the film where it's my Plan 9 from Outer Space moment, where I'm just like, oh man, it's where I'm choking her, and I'm basically force choking her because I thought we were doing just from the face up shot, and so I was just putting my hands there. Just
don't blame me.
Yeah. Because we had done other shots where there were, you know, but where I was actually strangling her, but for some reason or another, they just weren't a good shot or something like that.
For good reason. He didn't want to kill the actress, so he eased up a little too much.
Yeah, but it's, I also remember, like, with her, she was like, they wanted me to, like, you know, put my thumbs on her eyeballs and start pressing in and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, God. I'm like, oh, I don't want to hurt her.
I can't do that.
Yeah, and she's like, no, go ahead and do it. It gives me something to work on. If it's too much, I'll let you know. I'm like, are you sure?
When you hear.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like, oh, God. Okay.
That's right, Brent.
Oh, she's still got an eye.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this eyeball stuff freaks me out anyway because I've had eye surgeries and stuff like that. So anything that I've, like, is like broken arms and stuff like that I see in movies, those are the things that freak me out because it's stuff I can empathize with. Right. And so, yeah, it's like that's one of the first things I'm doing is an eyeball thing. I'm like, oh, God. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. But it was great. It was a great team effort. And by the end of the shoot, you know, yeah, like when I'm having to like pull Samantha's hair when she's going through the door and stuff like that, I'm like, okay, let's do it. And she's like, give it to me. I'm like, okay.
So you're saying you became hardened?
I did. I always say I'm probably the whiniest one on set too, because I have the boniest knees. And anytime like, okay, we got to get down this ground, I'm like, I'm gonna have knee pads. It hurts, and like I always have to hand it to
Damien.
Yeah, it is true because I have
Art
to hand
the diva
it.
The things you don't.
I am such a diva. I have to hand it to my female co-stars, especially. They all in both films are just the biggest ass kickers. They don't whine like I do. That's the funny part of it all. It's like I'm the villain. I'm like, it's cold. You got to put more blood on me, but it's cold. And there's Lauren standing over there in basically a bikini in like 20 degree weather, or Catherine hanging upside down naked in 20 degree weather, and I'm like I'm cold. It's like,
so Damien, a lot of people accuse horror filmmakers in particular of misogyny, and I know that has happened to you.
Oh, sure.
Let's talk about that perception of how horror films are made and women as victim and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's part of the formula of film that I grew up just loving.
You're a child of the 80s, and you're making films inspired by the 80s.
That's it. It's all about the final girl. And I love that. I love seeing, I mean, it's like you got to walk on eggshells to even kind of talk about this stuff now. But I mean, I think it's more impactful because I think a woman's more vulnerable, just physically vulnerable, and you're rooting for her more. To survive at the end. If you have, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger like fighting the Predator, it's like, you're all right. He's probably gonna make it out at the end. You know, it's not as intense, it's not as scary, but it's just, again, it's such a huge part of the genre. I love it. I love strong, powerful females. Like, my favorite character of all time is Ripley from Aliens, from James Cameron's Aliens.
Yeah, I mean, she's the victor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And she is strong as hell.
Yeah, but it's also not about her being a female. It's like they don't just like shove that down your throat the entire. It's never. She's never. Her gender's really never pointed
it's
out.
It's not political
at all. So, you know, I don't really look at it that way. I'm not a misogynist. I mean, I always say I was raised by all women, my entire family. So again, I think I might even feel just closer because I think the idea of it's just so ridiculous that I don't mind doing truly horrible things to women in a movie because it couldn't be further from the truth. So I don't let things like that get to me. I don't have time to think about being a misogynist or anything like that.
Fair enough. Yeah. And so, David, tell me about what it felt like being in costume for the first time on the first day of shoot.
That was fun. That was a lot of fun in that regard. It was really cool seeing me as a creature like that, because I had done a lot of, you know, community theater and stuff like that, so I would have makeup, but it was always just the painted on, nothing like prosthetics and stuff. But to see myself become this creature, that was really exciting. I was having a lot of fun with that and taking pictures, all that kind of stuff. This is real. I'm actually doing a movie.
And you're all costumed up, so that has to give you a sense of power being in character, too.
It does. That goes just back to my stage days. I'm not one of those method actors where I have to be in character the whole entire time. It's like, as soon as I'm in the costume and makeup, even when I was on stage doing plays, it's like everything just takes shape. It's like the posture changes, all that kind of stuff. It just, I know who the character is immediately.
Well, I remember when I was doing Michael Jackson's Thriller, I was one of the zombies, and it was 3 hours to put on the makeup and an hour to take it off. And I discovered how claustrophobic I am, and I would never do it again.
Did you have to get a life cast, or did they put like a...
Yeah, I had a life cast, and that was tough. Then I found out from Rick Baker, who was doing the life cast, that Clint Eastwood couldn't do it either. So it was like, okay, we're all right.
Those life casts can
But tell me about that experience of being under prosthetic makeup for the first time.
It was different because I became very self-conscious of certain things because, especially with that version of it, it's last one where we're using the gelatin mask still. And my mouth would fall apart all the time because any little bit of moisture would just dissolve it. And the prosthetic teeth I would wear would make me drool all the time. And then we'd be in cold locations, so my nose would run all the time, too.
So everything was falling
apart. Oh, yeah. That's why you probably see some of these behind-the-scenes photos of me with Q-tips in my nose. That was why. I was trying to keep my nose from running all the time into the makeup. But it would be one of those things where, you know, he's wanting me to do a big, huge smile. I'm like, I'm afraid to right now because this is all going to go bleh and just kind of fall apart. He's like, oh, we'll just throw more blood on it. It'll be fine.
It'll hide anything. Blood hides sins.
Yeah.
I mean, we should have been using foam latex, but because that will stand all 12 hours on his face. I mean, that's the traditional.
And that's the standard.
I mean, now it's all silicones and things, but it's very toxic. It's very hard to make foam latex, and you need to bake it in an oven, and I just didn't have access to any of this. So gelatin's not toxic. You can, it might be a little toxic, but you can at least. I don't know how safe it is.
It's cow's hooves anyway.
That's why I went gray.
But you could, they sell it in cubes, and you could just melt it in your microwave, and you can then just pour it into your molds, and you have a prosthetic in like a half an hour. You put it in your freezer or whatever, and if it doesn't come out good, you could remelt it, and it's just so much easier. But the downside is that it's like it's going to start falling apart around his mouth and stuff. If anything gets wet or humidity, it's going to start breaking down. So we'd always have to bring him back to the makeup room, and I'd have to constantly be patching him up. So that was tough, but now I found an oven that I could put on my porch and bake foam latex.
So Terrifier becomes a word-of-mouth hit in a way that people watch it on the platforms and it's there in a way that doesn't make you rich. But having a success as an independent filmmaker means next time around, things are a little bit better. So here comes Terrifier 2. And tell me about the genesis of that, how that bounced off of the success of the first one.
Yeah, so we were, again, so now it grew in popularity big time. So it was easier to raise money this time. I mean, my producer, again, because he put up the money for the first time, he was going to put up like double the amount of money the second time around. And, you know, we were going to try and just make it the same way, more or less. We'd spoken to other people about giving us money, but again, there's limitations that come along with it, and just, you know, wanting to put handcuffs on you, and it can't be this violent, you can't do this and that. And it's like, we'll just make it on our own again, because we don't want to have all these eyes over us. But when I was writing it, I wrote now you've seen part two, it's the clown cafe scene was really big. I was like, there's no way we can shoot this scene. I'm going to need more money. So I was like, let's do an Indiegogo campaign for this scene specifically.
I'm like, at least, and then we'll raise some money. I'll be able to shoot it. So I asked for $50,000 on Indiegogo, and within a day, we hit $220,000.
Well, there's your budget.
And there's the budget. I mean, and that was a big eye-opener because, again, the whole way, we didn't quite know what we had, how big this was. We knew it had gotten bigger. But when I saw that happen in one day, I was like, oh, my God. I was like, maybe we have something, like, really big here. And thank God we raised that money because we would have never been able to shoot the movie we shot without that money. I mean, forget it. I was living in a fantasy world, so to speak. But so then we shot the movie. And, again, then trying to find distribution again, everybody's lowballing you. Nobody wants to give you any money up front or anything. And it got to the point where we're like, you know what, we're just going to self-distribute this. And we were so close to self-distributing the movie. And this was so weird. While we were shooting the film, a sales agent had reached out to us in our email. And I just always remembered. I just always kept her in the back of my mind. And we were so close to self-distributing. And I told Phil, I said, remember that woman that reached out? I said, why don't we just reach out to her and see if she could do anything? Maybe she can take it and bring it to some people. And we did, and she was just so happening to go to the Cannes Film Market, where it's basically like a convention like this, where you just buy and sell movies. And she took it there, and she was shopping it around for a week. Again, there's some interest, a lot of lowballing, and we're like, listen, we know what this thing is. We're just sticking to our guns. Like, we're gonna self-distribute if nobody comes in with an offer we're happy with. And of course, like on the last day she was there, the company, now Bloody Disgusting, now their partner is Cineverse. That's what they're officially called now.
Right.
They said, we love this movie.
Like, and they own Screenbox as
yes.
well.
They saw it and they were like, they just got it. They knew what it was. And they said, we want to use this movie to sort of be a springboard for Screenbox. They were just trying to like kick that off. And they said, you know, they made us such a great deal. It was very respectful. They knew what it was, and luckily we went with them, and it turned out to be a really big success.
Well, the great thing is it not only was a good deal, but you got a theatrical out of it, and it turned into a theatrical hit, which nobody anticipated.
Quite nobody. Nobody.
Tell me about opening night, going to the theater and seeing it with an audience for the first time.
It was pretty friggin' insane. And it took a while to sink in that we were seeing. Wow, what were you gonna say?
Oh, I just remember that night because we went to a showing in Staten Island. We just sat in the audience on opening night, and like we went to a bar afterwards, and we just all of a sudden seen like Twitter just starting to explode.
Yeah.
We're like, what?
Wow. I mean, there's an AMC literally like 2 minutes away from my house, and you go in there and my apartment, and you go in there and it's they have the poster of Terrifier 2 like in the, you know, the marquee in the lobby, and I'm like, this is like so surreal. Like, they don't know I live, you know, a stone's throw away from the theater or anything like that. So, but again, and that's Cineverse. Like, I wouldn't even imagined in a million years a theatrical release. You're talking a sequel slasher that's over 2 hours long, it's unrated. It's just, these things don't really happen. And they're like, no, we're going to really push to get this in theaters, and we're going to put in mainstream movie theaters and like 800 theaters or whatever. And I'm like, all right, this sounds great. I'm like,
and
I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah.
And then it just really, well, what happened was it, you know, we have just, seriously, like you guys, we have like an amazing fan base, just like the best. So like everybody who supported us from part one, like they all showed up to see it that weekend. But what happened is that reports started coming out that people were fainting and getting sick. And
Exorcist complex.
The Exorcist. This is real. These were real. Like, everybody thought that it was sort of a marketing
People were
ploy.
Actually slipping on vomit on the way out. Yeah. Okay.
So the greatest thing I ever saw was that Sunday, I went to see it again with my DP in the city, now in Manhattan. And we get in the lift and we're going back home, and I'm going through Instagram, and there is a picture, there's a tweet, and the guy says, was just in Terrifier, like just got out of Terrifier 2. This is what's going on in the lobby. And it's a guy like sitting in a chair with an emoji blocking his face, and like two paramedics coming in and the Terrifier 2 poster like over his shoulder.
And now that's a moment of pride.
Moment of pride. I'm like, do you see this? And then someone else is like, just left Terrifier 2. Someone puked in the theater, and then there's like a shot of vomit on the floor. And like, this real things. Like every con we're at, someone comes up to us and they tell us about their theatrical experience of someone leaving during the alley bedroom scene, or like someone getting sick, or my friend passed out and hit his head. That was another tweet that I saw. My friend passed out in the theater, cut his head, and some guy's like doing this, like blood. Like ridiculous. But it is an unrated, brutal movie. So if you're getting casual horror fans who really never saw part one, don't know what they're walking into, and then you hit them with that bedroom scene in the middle, it's pretty understandable. Like, some people can't handle that, especially now everybody's going in on edibles and they're getting high. You don't know what you're walking into. I would have a fucking panic attack watching that.
Well, what about the brutality of it? You know, the purpose behind that, you obviously want to exceed what has come before.
Correct. And I'm all about exploiting. I happily exploit the violence.
An extremity.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, part of it comes from being a makeup effects artist, doing the makeup, wanting to outdo my prior work, and wanting to show the audience things that they haven't seen before. And a lot of that came from when I was starting out and I needed to, you know, I needed someone to discover me. I needed my work to stand out. And my mindset's always, why is somebody going to talk about your movie or watch your movie when they can watch somebody else's, or they can go and watch a Hollywood movie with a $100 million budget or something like that? So I would put really shocking imagery and really terrible things in the movies. And even what Terrifier 1 in particular, the hacksaw scene, everybody who read the script, that was the first thing they... Cause on paper, that is the most generic, ridiculous killer clown movie. It's like, you don't know. It just, there's nothing there. You're like, even Art the Clown's not going to jump off of the page. But when you read the hacksaw scene, that's the first thing everybody would bring up to me when they read it. They're like, that's...
Bring up, yeah. Okay.
They're like, are you really going to... Even he said it to me after he read it. He goes, are you really going to... Well, you could tell when...
Yeah. I was like, I thought that what was described there was just for, you know, our reading pleasure. It's just like, okay, this is what we're supposed to be simulating, but we're not actually going to show that. I'm like, are we? He's like, no, we're actually going to show all of that. I'm like, oh my God, we're going to change the game here, because no one does that, especially in the past decade or so. They have shied away from that kind of violence in these types of movies. And I think that's why, like, slashers in the past decade or so have kind of gone on the wayside, because people are too afraid to take the risks anymore with us. And that's why people love to go to slashers. They love to see the over-the-top kills and stuff like that. And
yeah, but that being said, that's not going to carry your film alone the whole
right.
way.
Right, if there's no story, if there's no character, yeah. If it's just kill after kill, yeah. It's Friday the 13th. Well, sorry.
Well, but so thankfully, I mean, Art the Clown really carried part one. I mean, he was just, and we knew he was going to be the focal point. That was kind of a, I don't want like calling it a proof of concept movie, but it really was like, this is, you're here to see this character. It's like, we're just throwing everything we have at the wall. And it's just like, will you accept, will you embrace this character? And that's really what it was. It was just him doing his thing, and we just wanted to leave an impression. And luckily it worked, but the violence was a big part of that as well. But then going into part two, you know, I had to up my game. I had to grow as a filmmaker and as a writer, especially. I mean, that was my main goal. And now I wanted to incorporate a protagonist that the audience could really get behind. And if I could get them rooting for her, because they, even though they love Art the Clown so much, then I knew that I really did a decent job. And that was the goal. It was really getting protagonists and heroes on board that you could empathize with by the end of the movie. So.
Well, it has been announced that there is a Terrifier 3 coming.
There is a Terrifier 3, yes. Thank you.
Now, there have been a lot of Michael Myers, and there have been a lot of Jason Voorhees. Will you be returning as Art the Clown?
Hell yeah.
Hell
yeah. I'm not giving this guy up. He's too much fun. I got still too much I want to do with him.
And I'm sure that's mutual.
Yes, yes.
But Damien, George Romero had the problem.
My hero, one of my biggest heroes.
The greatest. He could only make Living Dead movies. That's all anybody would let him make. And it gave him a great career. And he made a few things other than that, but they were not successful, and nobody wanted to see him that way. Do you have any fear of being pigeonholed as the Art the Clown guy?
No. I would be absolutely honored if that's my legacy. Yeah. But I'm so, this whole experience is so surreal. We're so grateful to be in this situation. And again, it's like George Romero, John Carpenter, Wes Craven, all those guys that I grew up absolutely loving, right? Like they didn't admire slashers. Like they invented that genre, right? I'm sure they looked up to Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, the Universal classics.
Hitchcock,
right? But me, I admired those guys. I admired slashers. I was in love with those movies. And then to kind of go full circle and now contribute, give something back in the same genre that I grew up loving, the same subgenre of slashers, is the most special thing imaginable. I mean, I was telling somebody yesterday that as a kid, I was Tommy Jarvis in Friday the 13th Part 4. Like, I was the little Corey Feldman kid to a T. I just wasn't like a tech wizard. But like, my room was just all masks and model kits and everything. I was surrounded by that. So to be able to give back and give you guys some kind of pleasure and a little bit of escape with this character just means the world. So I would absolutely make killer clown movies for the rest of my life if that's all I can make. If it makes you guys happy, I would love to do it.
You and the Kyoto brothers.
That's right.
So what are your comfort food movies? What are the movies that you can watch over and over? If it comes on, you'll turn it on and leave it on all the way through.
So many. But I'm not just a horror fan by any means. I'm a movie fan. But I mean, again, like I said, Jaws, The Lost Boys, Godfather 1 and 2, I could watch anytime. Goodfellas, I love those. Rocky, Return of the Living Dead. I watch every time I'm on a plane, I watch Return of the Living Dead.
Excellent. How about you, David?
Well, of course, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is one of mine. That's my all-time favorite movie anyway. I just think it's a perfect film. It's just and some movie that can never be done today the way it was done back then and have the same kind of effect.
Cell animation.
Yeah, it was just perfect. It was perfect. They would all rely on CG now instead of actually hand-drawn cell animation and puppeteering. And it's just, love that movie. I just go on for, I could have a whole entire podcast about my love for that movie. But I'm a big, huge comedy guy, too, especially Mel Brooks movies or the classics like the Marx
Brothers. I got
to
work with Mel when I wrote The Fly, too. He was my producer.
Oh,
so,
gosh.
Brooks films.
He's one of my... I actually got to briefly meet him a month into living in New York City, and that was an amazing experience for me because...
Wonderful man.
Oh, my! This tells you how wonderful this man was because... I was in an audition for a tour of Fiddler on the Roof, and we were having our audition in the room next door to where they were doing the read-through for Young Frankenstein, the musical, and they take a break, and so you see all these, like, great Broadway legends coming out, like, you know, Roger Bart and Kristen Chenoweth, all these people, and, you know, Peter Boyle's right before he passed away, he comes out, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. It's like a month into living in New York. This is a kid from Alabama. I'm like, I can't believe all this going on here. This is so cool. And then Mel Brooks comes out, and everybody else would just walk by us, hi. He stopped and came up to every single one of us waiting in line for our audition and asked us our name and, you know, told us, you know, break a leg on our audition. And I'm
great.
Like, that spoke volumes to me about his character that, you know, he was on his lunch break. He didn't have to do that. Yeah. He's Mel Brooks. But he just saw all these young artists out there. He wanted to wish us all the best on our auditions. And that was an amazing, I couldn't talk. I was just totally, I was just saying, hi, David. Hi, nice to meet you. I love you. Yeah. I did it because he's my comedy god. It's like, he's created so many of my favorite, of course, you know, Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles is just one. That's a movie. If anytime that movie comes on, I am watching it. In the Pink Panther movies, I will watch it. Like Peter Sellers, I was just like, I love those movies, and they're movies you don't see anymore.
Yeah,
no one makes those type of movies anymore, and I miss them.
Wait, can I say this? I'm not just saying this to blow smoke. This is a true comfort film. I've mentioned this to you before. As you know, this guy's body of work is beyond astonishing. Have you guys ever seen Amazing Stories, the anthology from the 80s? All right. So if you like Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, this was an anthology show produced by Spielberg, right? So he wrote one of the greatest episodes of any anthology ever. It's called Go to the Head of the Class, starring Christopher Lloyd. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis, right? Back to the Future, Forrest Gump. And it's about these two kids who want to put a spell on their sort of sadistic teacher, and it goes horribly awry. I won't say what happens, but if you haven't seen it, you have to watch it. It is absolutely incredible. I watch it once a year on Halloween.
That's very kind
of
you.
I really do.
Thank
you
so
much. It's one of my favorite things ever.
Well, we better wrap it up on that. So, well, thank you, Damian Leone and David Howard Thornton.
Oh, thank you, sir.
It's just been such a pleasure, and thanks to the audience for joining us for this. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mick.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.